In the previous chapter of 2 Samuel, we saw something that ought to give us great pause, if not perhaps a little bit of discomfort. It is that although David was forgiven as an act of grace by Yahweh, God of Israel, and although the Lord again showed David favor, neither he nor his family nor his government administration ever fully recovered from the immorality of the David and Bathsheba affair. It had permanently damaged David and the kingdom. And as we follow the progress of David, we are going to see a steadily weakening man brought low by the burden of all the continuous succession of heartbreaks and calamities that were laid upon him at the very hand of the one who had forgiven him. David well understood that the source of his troubles was his own sin, and also the judgment of God, who has no choice in his perfect holiness but to let David feel the sting of rebuke and of divine justice. Why ought we pay such close attention to this bit of tragic history? It's certainly not so that we can show proper Christian sympathy, understanding towards David's troubles. Rather, it's that we need to wake up. We need to understand that the way the Lord treated David is the pattern after which we're all going to be treated. How many people who have sincerely prayed that sinner's prayer, faithfully gone to church on countless Sundays, happily placed 10% of their income into that silver offering plate, how many of those have dejectedly walked away from God because they experienced his harsh hand upon them in response to their sin? And this is because of a horribly misguided doctrine that's been taught by church leadership, whose goal is to make God seem more attractive in hopes that more of the lost world will walk through their doors. And often as a result of that doctrine, those who feel God's severity feel betrayed, that this implied promise of immunity from the earthly repercussions of their rebellion, all this turned out to be a false expectation. The Holy Scriptures, Old and New Testaments, testify in harmony that sin will be and must be responded to by the Lord, or he's not a just God. And because Yahweh is a just God, sin will, and it is, responded to on two levels, spiritually and earthly. And so, because all sin is first and worst, a trespass against the Lord, a spiritual payment is due to him. And that spiritual payment has been made for those who trust in the one who made it, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Christ. But that earthly penalty, that one's also due, depending on the nature of the sin. Sometimes the payment is through the justice system of human governments, which, by the way, God created and ordained, is an authorized means to carry out justice. Other times it is payment directly caused by God, and we're going to see especially that happen in David's life, because as a king, he was beyond the reach of human government. Now, if it makes you feel a little bit better to define God's actions against you for your sinning as discipline, go ahead and be my guest. But you know, if that's going to be your decision, then assign that word, that same term, to all these horrors that we're going to see visited upon David's family. Because what is befalling David is of the same nature, the same intent, as what befalls us when we consciously choose to defy our God and His commandments, and then we trespass upon His holy nature. 2 Samuel chapter 13 follows the chapter wherein Yehovah pronounced His judgment upon David that the sword was never going to leave his household. This means that divinely ordained treachery, violence, and death would play out for generations to come among David's closest descendants. What we are about to read now and dissect is sometimes called Amnon's incest. The perverted behavior and the immorality depicted in this chapter has been somewhat watered down, especially in the English translations of the original Hebrew manuscripts. And as we get into it, it's going to become obvious as to why that happened. So I want to give you a caution. Just as modern day films require a rating system, a warning that the contents may not be suitable for all audiences, I want you to be aware that the contents of this chapter might be offensive, maybe a little disturbing to some of you who, and it may be a bit intense for younger children. I can't possibly know who among you has special sensitivities to sexual violence and violation, nor can I know whether your children are properly prepared or mature enough so that when they hear what happens, they can handle it. That's going to be up to you. I just want you to know what's coming so you can make that decision. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to try to keep the words discreet. I'm not going to be overly graphic. On the other hand, this is God's word. I can't just bypass it. I can't go around the difficult parts. And I also can't blunt the impact that these passages are supposed to have on us. So with that, open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 13. That's page 346 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 2 Samuel chapter 13. Now Avshalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister named Tamar. Sometime after the previous events, Amnon, the son of David, fell in love with her. Amnon became so obsessed with his sister Tamar that he became ill. For she was a virgin, and Amnon thought it would be impossible to approach her. But Amnon had a friend named Yonadab, the son of Shema, David's brother. And Yonadab was a very shrewd fellow. He asked him, "Why, son of the king, are you growing thinner every day? Won't you tell me?" And Amnon answered him, "I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Avshalom's sister." And Yonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed. Pretend you're sick. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Oh, please, let my sister Tamar come and give me food to eat and have her prepare the food where I can watch. I'll eat what she serves me.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended that he was sick. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Oh, please let my sister Tamar come and make me a couple of cakes here where I can watch and I'll eat what she serves me." And David sent this instruction home to Tamar: "Go now to your brother Amnon's house, prepare him some food." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down, and she took dough, and she kneaded it, and made cakes while he watched, and baked the cakes, and then she took the pan and turned them out in front of him, but he refused to eat. Amnon said, "Had everyone leave me?" Everyone left him. Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the room so that I can have you serve me." Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the room to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near so that he could eat, he grabbed her and said to her, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "No, my brother," she answered, "and don't force me. Things like this aren't done in Israel. Don't behave so disgracefully. Where could I go with such shame? And as for you, you'll be regarded as one of Israel's vulgar brutes. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, because he won't keep me from you." However, he wouldn't listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he overpowered her and raped her. But then he was filled with utter revulsion for her. His hatred of her was even greater than the love he had for her before. And Amnon said to her, "Get up, get out of here." "No," she objected, "because throwing me out like this is an even worse thing than what you've already done to me." But he wouldn't listen to her, and he called his personal servant and said, "Get rid of this woman for me. Throw her out. Lock the door after her." She was wearing a long-sleeved robe. This was how they used to dress the king's daughters who were virgins. His servant took her out, locked the door after her, and Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her long-sleeved robe that she was wearing, laid her hand on her head, and went off, crying aloud as she went. Avshalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now, my sister, keep quiet, because he's your brother. Don't take the matter to heart." But Tamar remained desolate in her brother Avshalom's house. And when King David heard about all these things, he became very angry. As for Avshalom, he refused to say a word to Amnon, either good or bad, for Avshalom hated Amnon for having raped his sisters Tamar. 2 years later, when Avshalom had sheep shears in Baal Hatzor near Ephraim, Avshalom invited all the king's sons. Avshalom went to the king and said, "Your servant has sheep shears. Please let the king and his servants come along with your servant." And the king replied to Avshalom, "No, my son, let's not all go. We don't want to be a burden to you." And Avshalom pressed him, but he wouldn't go. However, he gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If you won't go, then please let my brother Amnon go with us." The king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom kept pressing him, so he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Absalom ordered his servants, "Now pay close attention. When Amnon is in the high spirits from drinking wine, and I say to you, kill Amnon, then strike him down. Don't be afraid, because I'm the one ordering you to do it. Take courage. Be bold." Avshalom's servants did to Amnon as Avshalom had ordered. At this, all the king's sons jumped up, mounted their mules, and fled. And while they were on their way, the news came to David that Avshalom had killed all the king's sons. Not one of them was left alive. The king got up and tore his clothes and lay on the ground, while all his servants stood by with their clothes torn too. But then Yonadav, the son of Shema, David's brother, spoke up. He said, "My lord shouldn't think they have killed all the young men, the king's sons. Only Amnon is dead, for Absalom has meant to do this ever since the day he raped his sister Tamar. So my lord, the king shouldn't take it as seriously as if all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead." However, Absalom took flight. The young man keeping watch looked up and saw many people coming along the road behind him on the hillside. Yonadav said to the king, "Here, the king's sons have come. It's just as your servant said." The moment he finished speaking, the king's sons came and cried out and wept. And the king too, with all his servants, cried out in great pain. Avshalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. David mourned for his son every day. So Avshalom fled and went to Geshur and stayed there 3 years. But as King David became reconciled to the death of his son Amnon, he was increasingly filled with a longing to see Avshalom. The setting is that we're somewhere around the 20th year of David's reign, a little later than that, perhaps not any earlier. Amnon's sin is but the beginning of this long series of domestic troubles, even coup attempts in David's household. Now, David had become self-indulgent, therefore also indulgent of his children. He had given them a bad example in many areas of life. Most of them, you know, weren't around in his glory days of such admirable faith and trust in the Lord that led to his assumption of the throne. So it was the less desirable characteristics of their father that they mostly witnessed. And of course, they picked up on it as but the rights of privileged royalty. Now, I've stated on numerous occasions that while so many Bible stories seem to come to us out of left field, so to speak, But in fact, there was usually a logical context to why the characters chose to act as they did, and that their behavior and their motivations weren't much different than what drives us in our time. Bible scholars, as well as the ancient sages, reasonably conjecture that the background for what we see happening with Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom revolved around competition for succession to the king's throne. This was no small matter. It was a deadly serious game because the rewards of success were enormous. And since David had so many children by so many wives, the number of competitors wrestling for position was huge. Amnon was David's firstborn. He was the son of David's wife, Ahinoam, who we read about back in chapter 3. And it seems that Absalom was generally considered as second in line behind Amnon to be king when David died. Absalom's position as second in line came about not as a result of being the second born, he probably wasn't, but because not only was he the legitimate son of King David, he was also the grandson of another king on his mother's side, who was the king of Geshur. Both sides of his family were royalty. Sadly, their mutual sister Tamar played the role of a political pawn in both Amnon's and Absalom's ruthless designs to position themselves to be the next king of Israel. Now, verse 1 informs us that Absalom had a very beautiful sister named Tamar. Their mother was Maakah, daughter of the king of Geshur. And although the scriptures infer that the two were indeed brother and sister in the same way we'd all think of that, some of the ancient sages, and then later the rabbis, said that they had different mothers. Now I want to get this out of the way up front by explaining their reasoning for their conclusions, because the relationship between Absalom and Tamar is central to this story. Now, I've spoken before of the exaggerated, carnal, and even completely contrary teachings of the rabbis about David and about his life story, as compared to the generally plainly worded text of the Bible. And the reason for this is that David is seen by Judaism as virtually sinless, very nearly the same way as Christians view Christ. And he's viewed almost as the first appearance of the Messiah. So no matter what scripture may say, David is defended and meanings are violently twisted to make things turn out in his favor. So while verse 1 implies nothing other than Absalom and Tamar being brother and sister in every biological sense, some rabbis go to great length to claim that they weren't. Rather, they say that although they, along with Amnon, had a common father, David, three separate mothers were involved. So each was a step-sibling to the other. Another opinion by the Rabbi Mahari Kara admits that Absalom and Tamar had the same mother, Maakah, but that Tamar wasn't really David's daughter. Rather, she even had a different father. Now, the goal of all of this Judaistic gerrymandering of relationships among Amnon, Absalom, and Tamar is to reduce the blame on David to effectively zero. To make it that Amnon and Tamar could have legally married, so that the crime was far less significant than what it might seem. In other words, if Tamar had an entirely different set of parents than Amnon, well, then there was no incest. Not at all. And their marriage would have solved any legal issues that this grisly scene would have caused. In my view, none of these views are credible. They're just fanciful imaginings of those whose number one goal is to protect the doctrines of Judaism in the synagogue. And before, by the way, anybody thinks this is some kind of rant against either of those, I want to state that our beloved church has done the same sorts of things for at least 1,800 years. There's plenty of guilt and responsibility to go around, trust me. So it's going to be my position throughout that Absalom and Tamar are full brother and sister, and Amnon is their half-brother, all having David as their common biological father, just as the texts say. Well, with the relationship established, let's move on. Now, even though the end of verse 1 states that Amnon fell in love with Tamar, verse 2 immediately defines the type of love this amounted to. It was sexual obsession. Amnon was just struck with an erotic lust for Tamar. The last thing he had on his mind was to make Tamar his wife in order to start a family. We're informed that Tamar was a virgin, and while in modern Western society that term only explains that that person had never had a sexual relationship, in Hebrew society it means that plus some other things. First, it means that the person's a female. Males were never called virgins. Second, it means a girl was young. Third, it means the girl was still living in her father's household, under his authority, and that she had never been married. And while that means that she was available for marriage, the end of verse 2 says clearly that Amnon knew he couldn't have any kind of relationship with her beyond a sister and brother relationship. Some rabbis say that the words mean that Amnon couldn't have anything to do with her only because she was a virgin. But unless that means he was barred from having sex with her because of her virgin status, then that argument isn't fruitful. There was no restriction of a man having a relationship with a virgin. It merely couldn't include a sexual relationship. Courting, within the super modest Hebrew concept of courting, was usual. It was normal. It was perfectly allowed by the law of Moses. It didn't matter at all whether the girl was a virgin or not as regards a sexual relationship. Sex outside of marriage, even if the woman was a widow or a divorcee, is forbidden. It's obvious that Amnon's disappointment was that because Tamar was his half-sister, the law didn't permit incest, nor did it permit their marriage, so he couldn't have sex with her, and that make the whole scriptures make it clear that was his goal. Now, it's interesting to me that Amnon succumbed to the same character flaw and crime as his father did. We see a very similar theme in that David had developed this uncontrollable lust for Bathsheba, based on her rare beauty. And then David's son, Amnon, succumbs to the same kind of thing. Only this time, if it were even possible, Amnon's improper desires are even worse than his father's. Now, why this is interesting is because we see the Lord supernaturally handing down proportional justice upon David, just as he said he would do. It's the classic eye for an eye principle, whereby because David lusted after a woman who was legally taboo for him, so now his firstborn son lusts after a woman who was legally taboo for him. And the result of both cases would be domestic violence and death. Remembering now that a lot of jockeying for position to succeed King David was behind these actions of David's family, we are introduced to Yonadab, a cousin of Amnon. And Yonadab saw an opportunity here to advance himself. He noticed that Amnon was looking depressed. So he asked him what the problem was, and Amnon freely told him. And the wily Yonadav devised a plan to lure Tamar into Amnon's chambers. The plan was that Amnon was to get into his bed and pretend he was sick. And David would do his fatherly duty by coming to visit Amnon. And then Amnon, looking pitiful and half dead, well, he'd tell his father, you know, Dad, maybe if my half-sister Tamar came by to fix me some food, I might find the strength to eat it and feel better. Yeah, that'd do it. And since at that time in particular, it was a woman's job to fix food, attend to men, and be a comforter, David agreed. And while Amnon was indeed pretending to be physically ill, there's no doubt that he was sincerely lovesick, or better, overcome with lust, and genuinely in distress, no matter how self-centered the cause was. He would lie awake all night thinking about her and thus look haggard in the morning. The Jewish scholar Shimon Bar Efrat says that when spoken out loud, Amnon's deepest emotions are revealed in the words he chose to use to beg his father for his sister to come to him, because the words are arranged in such a way as to sound like this series of deep, heavy, forlorn sighs. I'll do my best with this. In English, it says, in 2 Samuel 13:5, please let my sister Tamar come and give me food to eat and have her prepare the food where I can watch. I'll eat what she serves me. But in Hebrew, it sounds like this. Et Tamar ahot avi a'i ani ohev. I mean, it's just very dramatic, very melancholy. Oh, I'm dying over here. Now, certainly the words were arranged and spoken in a dramatic way so as to bring David nearly to tears in sympathy for this greatly depressed son. I mean, what father could deny his son something as simple as having his own sister come and prepare him some food to eat, maybe lift his spirits? So David sends word to Tamar that she's to go to her ill brother and prepare him some food. And in verse 8, she complied. Tamar lived in a separate area of the city of David, away from her half-brother Amnon. And since David had a sizable harem, he would have had several virgin daughters of marriageable age. It's believed from some later verses and some other scriptural evidence that the virgin girls of the royal court lived more or less together in a kind of convent, a highly protected place. They lived separately from the men so that nothing immodest or worse could happen. In fact, as we'll see shortly, the virgins even wore a special uniform that both publicly testified to their virgin status and was especially lovely, but also very modest in its design. Now we're told that indeed she prepared the cakes, she baked them in Amnon's sight according to his request, and the cakes were a dumpling-like food. But in this context, there was a subtle double meaning buried in the Hebrew words that are chosen, which a Hebrew from that era would have immediately understood. It is that the first use of the phrase make cakes was levav. The second use, just a few words later, was leveva. The root word these are taken from is lev, which means heart. Thus, the name for this particular kind of cake that she baked was a heart cake, or heart dumplings. It's not that they were heart-shaped. They weren't Valentines. Rather, it is that heart cakes were a quickly prepared food that would, in old English style of talking, strengthen the heart. In other words, they tasted good. They provided a quick boost of energy. Today, we would call them comfort food. A food that brightens our mental outlook more than just filling up our bellies. But of course, we now see the double meaning. That the girl who was the cause of Amnon's heartache was fixing him with heart cakes. Now, before we move forward, also notice how it was that King David who facilitated, that it was King David who actually facilitated his virgin daughter Tamar going to Amnon. And this would lead directly to her being raped. And of course, this isn't what David intended, but it is an irony that no doubt it was all part of the Lord's punishment upon David, such that even attempting to show concern for his son ended up devastating his family. And once again, we see divine lex talionis, eye for an eye, playing out. David had cruelly used an unwitting messenger to go and fetch an unsuspecting Bathsheba to his palace so that he might have immoral and probably not completely unopposed sex with her. Now David himself is made the unwitting messenger that is used by Amnon to fetch the unsuspecting Tamar to the very man who would force himself on her, have immoral sex with her, and end her virginity. When Tamar had finished cooking the heart cakes and tried to serve them to her half-brother, he still refused to eat. In that kind of whimsical, authoritative way that only princes and princesses have at their disposal, he waves his hand and orders all of the servants, his and hers, that they were to immediately leave, vacate. He tells Tamar to bring those cakes into his bedchamber. Now imagine by now, Tamar was starting to get a feeling that things weren't quite right here. And she begins to serve him. When the supposedly ill and frail Amnon makes his move, he reaches out, he grabs her, he tells her of his desire to have sex with her, and Tamar attempts to escape by pointing out the inherent wickedness of Amnon's desire. No, my brother, she says, don't force me. Things like this aren't done in Israel. Don't behave so disgracefully. But Tamar, unequivocally uttering no to Amnon's advances, with all that, all of the sin of what was occurring now fell upon Amnon. Amnon was about to become a rapist. But inevitably, it was the woman, Tamar, the victim, who was going to suffer the most in all this. In verse 13, Tamar tries to bring Amnon to his senses by telling him that they were going to both suffer the worst shame from this, he continued. She, because of the loss of her virginity, he, because of the crime of rape and incest. Now, some have completely misinterpreted the final words of verse 13, speak to the king because he won't keep me from you, as meaning that David would find a way to allow Amnon and Tamar to be married so that they could avoid committing an immoral act. That's not the intent of that verse. As I mentioned earlier, the virgin girls were generally kept separated from the male population. But she was claiming that if Amnon insisted that he had such a deep affection for her as a sister, their father David wouldn't intentionally keep them from at least visiting one another maybe a little more often. By no means was either sex or marriage part of her meaning. Even the sages say that without doubt, Tamar was trying every tactic she could think of to talk her way out of this dangerous situation. It was to no avail. I mean, Amnon, well, he thought about this for a long time. He had played this out in his mind over and over again, and he was not going to be denied. I have no doubt that in some twisted way, he thought of this as romantic. I also have no doubt that he thought she'd comply and even hoped that she would be as anxious for this as he was. But in reality, none of that mattered. He was bigger, he was stronger, and so he forced himself. Let me say something. Before I go any farther, it needs to be spoken even among believers. Ladies, young women, girls especially, I want to tell you something about men that you might not understand. Something's not very flattering about us. But it's been this way for all ages. I don't think it's going to ever change until heaven and earth passes away. When something of this nature is approaching, what we're witnessing here between Amnon and Tamar, the only hope is for the woman to attempt to gain some measure of control over the situation. It's the only hope. Because it's unlikely the man's ever going to come to his senses. The best solution is, of course, ladies, for you to do all you can to keep yourself out of these kind of circumstances. But of course, in this case, Tamar didn't have any choice. Men, we love to talk about women's raging hormones. But let me tell you something, our hormones rage at least as strongly. And ours are the more problematic. Yours can be very frustrating to us. Ours can be downright criminal. Because we have a real easy way of just shoving right and wrong right off to the side. And the younger we are, the worse it is. Once Amnon had all these circumstances in his favor, it was like a lion herding an exhausted and frantic gazelle into a box canyon. The lion hadn't gone through all this trouble just to let the gazelle go now. By no means do I want to make light of what was happening, but ladies, at the moments of these intense sexual encounters, it's you who are the only ones who have any semblance of a working brain function. For men, the almost certain consequences for our rash behavior, especially when it comes to sex, finishes a distant second to what our hormones are telling us. I'm not rationalizing, believe me. I'm not deflecting male responsibility. I'm trying to tell you that of the many ways the Lord has made us delightfully different, one of them is that our sex drives operate very differently. You need to know that, if you don't already. Now, Tamar, she was concerned about the consequences. Amnon, he just wanted immediate gratification. The scriptures state that he just wouldn't listen to her. He would not hear her pleas to be obedient, if nothing else, to the laws of Moses as the chosen people had an obligation to be. And the truth is that women will always bear the unequal brunt of this kind of aftermath. Tamar's life was going to be ruined. She knew it. Now Amnon, he'd just move on. The minute Amnon was finished with her, we're told there's this revulsion for her that welled up inside of him. Tamar had resisted in every way. Her refusal, her disgust, essentially ruined the experience that he'd fantasized over for so long. His animal lust for her had instantly turned into a hatred that was even greater than his so-called love. Only now that his hormones are satisfied, does Amnon begin to contemplate all the earthly consequences of his fiendish foolishness. What this means for Tamar, that's nowhere in his thoughts. He blames her. Now things go from bad to worse. Amnon orders his victim to get off of his bed and leave. He didn't want the object of his unrequited passion to be in his sight any longer. She's horrified. Being sent away as though she was a street prostitute would be an even greater shame. What she had in mind by wanting to not yet leave is kind of hard to say. Possibly it was maybe a little more time to digest this calamity, to think about what to do next, maybe to kind of get her emotions, maybe even just her physical appearance back into some kind of order. Some rabbis say it was that she wanted to wait until nighttime, till the sun went down, so that she could maybe sneak away, not so noticed. Other rabbis say that despite the law against it, she wanted him to marry her now. And when we see what was going on in David's day, with a little mention of a functioning priesthood and the falling back to the common Middle Eastern customs and traditions in place of following the laws of Moses, it could well be that the marriage regulations about marriage and incest weren't being very, very vigorously enforced. And we're given an earlier example of this in the David and Bathsheba matter, but Amnon wasn't going to have any of it. He ordered his servants to throw Tamar out, even to lock the door behind her. Interestingly, sadly, verse 17 doesn't have Amnon saying, throw this woman out. Instead, he completely dehumanizes her. The Hebrew word for woman is isha. Amnon refers to her as etzot, this one. Throw this one out. He treats her like she was a stalker, a hanger-on, who's got to be kept away from him now. Now, whether or not the laws concerning sex and marriage were even being followed in David's day is up for debate, but let's just see what Deuteronomy has to say about this. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 22. We're going to read from 13 to 29. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 221. Starting at verse 13. If a man marries a woman and has sexual relations with her, and then, having come to dislike her, brings false charges against her and defames her character by saying, I married this woman, when I had intercourse with her, I did not find evidence that she was a virgin, then the girl's father and mother are to take the evidence of the girl's virginity to the leaders of the town at the gate. The girl's father will say to the leaders, I let my daughter marry this man, but now he hates her. So he's brought false charges that he didn't find evidence of her virginity, yet here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity, and they will lay the cloth before the town leaders. The leaders of that town are to take that man and punish him, fine him 2.5 pounds of silver shekels, which they will then give to the girl's father, because he has publicly defamed a virgin of Israel. She will remain his wife, and he is forbidden from divorcing her as long as he lives. But if the charge is substantiated, that the evidence for the girl's virginity could not be found, then they are to lead the girl to the door of her father's house, and the men of her own town will stone her to death. Because she has committed in Israel the disgraceful act of being a prostitute while still in her father's house. In this way you'll put an end to such wickedness among you. If a man is found sleeping with a woman who has a husband, both of them must die. The man who went to bed with the woman, and the woman too. In this way, you'll expel such wickedness from Israel. If a girl who is a virgin is engaged to a man and another man comes upon her in town and has sexual relations with her, you are to bring them both out to the gate of the city and stone them to death. Because the girl didn't cry out for help there in the city, and the man because he humiliated his neighbor's wife. In this way, you will put an end to such wickedness among you. But if a man comes upon the engaged girl out in the countryside, and the man grabs her and has sexual relations with her, then only the man with her who had intercourse with her is to die. You will do nothing to the girl, because she's done nothing deserving of death. The situation is like the case of the man who attacks his neighbor and kills him. For he found her in the countryside, and the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. If a man comes upon a girl who's a virgin but who is not engaged and he grabs her and has sexual relations with her and they're caught in the act, then the man who had intercourse with her must give to the girl's father 1 1/4 pounds of silver shekels, and she will become his wife because he humiliated her. He may not divorce her as long as he lives. Notice that in reality, the penalty for a man in this situation is primarily financial. For the woman, the loss of her virginity is a lifelong calamity. In fact, under certain circumstances, it can lead to her execution. No man wanted to marry a girl who wasn't a virgin unless she was a widow, perhaps, or a divorcee. Now, literally, a typical Jewish girl's financial worth to her family became almost zero if she were unmarried but not a virgin. Tamar is in a classic catch-22. By no fault of her own, she's no longer pure. The incest laws of Leviticus 18, verses 6 through 12 says that under no circumstances can she marry her half-brother. And that was the situation. On the other hand, now she can't marry anybody else. No other decent Hebrew man would marry this non-virgin because then it would bring shame upon him. As of now, she's an outcast. She's a pariah. It is unlikely she'll ever be able to fulfill her womanly duty to be fruitful and multiply. She'll almost certainly not be able to marry now. She will always be seen as one who was involved in incest, and wherever she goes, there will be those hushed tones, those disapproving looks following her around. I want to finish this up with verses 18 and 19. Here is described this long-sleeved virgin's robe that Tamar was wearing. And after she was thrown out the door, her clothes disheveled and torn, she couldn't hide her state. She threw ashes over herself as this unmistakable sign among Hebrews of mourning, of grief. And here's where our understanding of patterns helps us out. The word used to describe her virgin's robe in Hebrew is ketonet, ketonet. Now, it's a word that's rarely used in the Bible, but there is one other place where that word is used, and you'll recognize it immediately. It's the same word used for Joseph's coat of many colors. There is no doubt that the choice of this word, ketonet, is intended by the author to draw a graphic parallel between the final state of Joseph's tunic and that of Tamar's. You remember the significance of Joseph's tunic? After his brothers sold him to those Arab slave traders, they needed a believable story to explain his disappearance to their father, Jacob. So they rubbed goat blood all over the coat, handed it to Jacob, and they told him Joseph had been killed by a wild animal. So what we have here in 2 Samuel is an equally graphic sense. The violated, rejected Tamar was dressed in a ketonet. She's destroyed. She throws ashes over herself in despair, but there's something else on that tunic than just dirt and ashes. Blood. She was a young virgin. She was wearing the tunic all during the act. You recall that while this is a little hard for us to discuss in a mixed audience, in ancient times, there was the tradition of the marriage cloth, whereby newlyweds would consummate their marriage on a new white cloth, and the expectation of some blood upon it was highly anticipated by the bride's parents, because this was proof of their daughter's prior virginity. In fact, that cloth, called the marriage cloth, was carefully then stored away in perpetuity as legal evidence in case the husband ever wanted to divorce his wife and get his bride price back from the father. And that's if he used the excuse she wasn't a virgin when he married her, and so he had been defrauded. The blood on Tamar's virgin's ketonet was public proof she wasn't pure any longer. There was no hiding it. What should have been a prized marriage cloth was now permanent evidence of her lifelong shame. We're going to continue with chapter 13 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.